And we left off last week with the sounds of joy and laughter as Jairus and his wife and their daughter were sitting at the table celebrating the reuniting of their little family after Jesus raised the girl from the dead. And then in verse 27 of Matthew 9, it just another event comes, and they just come like waves one after another. As Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed him, calling out, "Mercy, Son of David." Now, these guys call out to Jesus, but in verse 28, we see that Jesus does not respond. He just seems to ignore them, just keeps right on walking and walks until he gets to his house and then goes in the house. It's interesting to notice Jesus' response whenever people call him by this title, Son of David. In Matthew 15, we see it in verse 22, a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession," and Jesus did not answer a word. We see it again in Matthew 20, verse 29. There are two blind men. See, they're sitting by the roadside, and Jesus passes by, and they hear Jesus going by, and they shout, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us," and Jesus says nothing. And the crowd responds, and they rebuke them, tell them to be quiet, but they shout all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Whenever people called Jesus Son of David, he never immediately answered. And that's probably because it was a political title. You see, the people back then were looking for a political Messiah. Somebody, and their term for that was Son of David. That was their favorite term for that figure because they wanted somebody like their hero, King David, who would come as a political figure and a revolutionary and defeat all of their enemies with the military. So you can see why Jesus was hesitant to respond to that title. That's not why he came the first time. It will be the second time, but not now. Jesus preferred the title Son of Man, right? Which emphasized more his divine nature and the fact that he can approach God. And if you want to read about that, you can read about that in Daniel 7, the meaning of Son of Man. But not only that, not only would Jesus be hesitant to respond because of the political connotations, but also, as we've seen again and again, that Jesus always puts up some obstacle in people's way. Whenever they come to him, he puts an obstacle in their way to test and build their faith and to turn away those whose faith was not real. And sometimes the obstacle was just simply not responding immediately. Jesus is walking down the road, and he's just moving along, and these guys start crying out and yelling, and he just keeps walking. And he goes into his house, as I said, and they keep following him right into his house. You know, Jesus' ministry is just relentless. It's absolutely unending. He had no privacy, no rest. It's just constant. So these men, they persist. They won't give up. They follow him into his house. And you know, that tells us something about these men. In a political situation, sometimes people will, you know, join a crowd and shouting something like, "Mercy, Son of David," or whatever. But as soon as Jesus goes around the corner, they forget all about it. And Jesus does not respond to that kind of thing. These guys are not like that. They persist. And Jesus doesn't attend to them until he's alone with them in the house. Just he and they. People will say lots of things in a crowd, but what you say in a crowd doesn't matter. The question isn't what you're like in a crowd. The real question is, what is it between just you and Christ? What is it like? A lot of people follow the crowd. I mean, a lot of people follow the crowd to church. A lot of people follow the crowd in singing and everything else. But the real issue is, what is the situation right now between you and Christ? Just you and Christ. What do you say to Christ in the isolation of your own soul? Well, Jesus gets these guys alone in the house. Then he speaks to them. And they ask for healing. And Jesus responds and says, the blind men came to him and he asked them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" Do you believe that I'm able? Now, when you study the Gospels, one thing that really stands out is that the essence of faith is believing in Christ's ability. His power. That's always the issue with faith. Faith is not believing that God will do something. Faith is believing that God can do something. Whether or not he will is up to him. Faith is only believing that God will do something if God has already promised to do that thing. If God has promised to do some specific thing, then yes, faith is believing that he will. And there are some things in that category. There are some things that God has promised to do so that we can have faith and believe that He will do them. For example, God has promised, if you're a believer, to take care of you. God has promised to forgive the repentant sinner. He's promised to save the believer. He's promised to work all things together for the good of for the called. He has promised all those kinds of things. And so in that case, faith is believing that He will do those things. You can just assume He will. But when you pray for some specific thing in your life, some specific request, it's really presumptuous to think that God will do it. That's not what faith is. What He wants you to believe is that He can do it and that He will do whatever's best. Some Christians, I'm making a point of this because some Christians actually get into the superstitious view of thinking that faith is just, if you believe hard enough that something will happen, that will make it happen. That is not faith. That's not biblical faith. In that case, the idea is that the key to getting your prayers answered is just believing hard enough and convincing yourself that they will be answered. That's not Christianity. That is just the power of positive thinking superstition that you hear preached by heretics like Robert Schuller or Word of Faith preachers like Kenneth Copeland and Hagen and Hinn and Joyce Myers and all them. Prayer and faith is not a magical incantation. Faith is not a force that is energized by our words or by human willpower. Faith is just simply trusting God, trusting in His power and in His love. Faith is believing that God can do anything and that He will do whatever's best. And that if it's possible to fit my request into whatever's best, then He'll do that. So Jesus doesn't ask these guys, do you believe that God will do this? He says, do you believe that I can do this? That's the issue. Also, I should also point out, He doesn't say, do you believe that I can get my Father to do it? Which is interesting because some people teach that when Jesus, in the incarnation, when Jesus became a man, He gave up the independent exercise of His attributes so that He couldn't function as God on His own. He had to ask the Father to do things. That is not what I believe, and it's not what these blind men believed, fortunately for them, because Jesus wants to know if they believe He can do it. And they reply in verse 28, yes, Lord. And then He touched their eyes and said, according to your faith, it will be done to you. And their sight was restored. Suddenly, instantly, their sight is restored. They can suddenly see everything. Christ was willing to heal them, and He planned on healing them, but He delayed. Because delay weeds out unbelief, and it exposes and strengthens true faith. People who pretend to have faith but don't, when God doesn't instantaneously respond to their request, tend to turn away, which is good because their lack of faith is exposed then. Those people, in this case, probably would have just cried out to Jesus one time, and when Jesus ignored them, they would probably just turn away and say, well, I knew He was a fraud anyway. Right? Those are the kind of people that say things like, I tried Christianity. It didn't work for me. Usually what that means is they came to Christ and made some demand and the Lord didn't instantly respond in the way they demanded and so they turned away. Delay is really a wonderful thing when it comes to God answering our prayers because it shows us how real our faith is. You know, Psalm 31:19, what a verse this is. How great is your goodness which you have stored up for those who fear you. Did you know that when you ask God for something and He doesn't respond immediately, you know what He's doing? All He's doing is He's storing up His kindness to you to be poured out in the future. See, God's timing is a wonderful thing. His timing is just as wonderful a gift as all His other gifts. It's just as good a gift as all His other gifts. So Christ raises Jairus' daughter from the dead, and then He gives sight to these blind men. Christ is the fountain of life, and He's the fountain of light. By raising the dead, He showed Himself to be the one who first breathed into man the breath of life. And by giving sight to the blind, He showed Himself to be the one who first commanded light to shine out of darkness. in Genesis 1. So in verse 29, he says, according to your faith, will it be done to you? Since they believed Jesus was able, he decided on the basis of that to go ahead and heal them. Now, don't confuse yourself on this statement. It doesn't imply, in the English, it kind of sounds like it implies something about proportionality, like the more faith you have, the better the result. That's not really the idea. He's just simply saying, since you've have faith, this is going to be done. Jesus healed the man in response to his faith. It didn't always work that way. Sometimes faith results in a miracle, like here. Other times, a miracle results in faith. And then still other times, there's no connection at all. This God just heals somebody, does a miracle without any mention of faith at all. And still other times, there's faith and no miracle. You see, you can't pigeonhole Jesus. He's sovereign over his own healing ministry, just like today. There's no magical formulas. We are never in a position to make any demands of him, just to make requests and then trust him. You know, it's worth noticing down in verse 34 that the people say, nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel. You know, that was always the response when Jesus gave somebody sight. In John 9, Jesus healed another blind man at a different time, a different place, and his response was the same thing. That man said to the Pharisees, nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. It's just never been done. That was always the miracle that people referred to when they wanted to make the strongest possible statement about Jesus' power. They would talk about the fact that he could give sight to the blind. When Lazarus died, some of the people said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? So when these people say, nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel, that's not an exaggeration. Did you know there are no miracles of giving sight to the blind in the Old Testament? Never happened. Never happened. And there's none in the New Testament either, other than the ones Jesus does. When Jesus commissioned the 12 apostles and sent them out and gave them miraculous power, he lists all the different miracles they'll be able to do. And they're amazing miracles, including raising the dead, but not giving sight to the blind. Only Jesus did that. It was rare. Never happened in the Old Testament. Never happened in the apostles' ministry. Only Jesus did it. But did you know that Jesus did more miracles of giving sight to a blind person than any other category of miracle? And that really paints a very important theological picture for us. It's not just a curiosity. It teaches us about the whole concept of enlightenment. And I did a study the other day of enlightenment. I just kind of went through Scripture, and it's really a fascinating thing to watch from the very beginning. You know, the very first reference to eyes in the Bible is when the eyes of Adam and Eve were opened when they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I wish I had some time to talk about this. When we get back into our Genesis study, we will. But, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was a good thing. You know, everything God created was good. Everything. Even the forbidden tree. I don't know why it was forbidden at that point. My guess is that it was only temporary. It seems to me most logical that God created the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because he wanted people to have the knowledge of good and evil, because that's a good thing. He didn't create any bad things. But it wasn't time yet for them. They were not ready for it. Adam and Eve were kind of like children. In fact, for all we know, they were children. I don't know. But they were, you know, they were unclothed and they weren't embarrassed about that, and they didn't have the knowledge of good and evil. They seemed to be like children, and they weren't ready yet, apparently, for the knowledge of good and evil. But at some point, they would have been, and I believe that that was why God made the tree. But we know it was a good thing. Now, what is the knowledge? What do you get when you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? You get, some people have said, well, that's when you learn the difference between good and evil. But that can't be the case, because Adam and Eve knew the difference. If they didn't know the difference between good and evil, what good would it do to give them a command not to eat of the tree? I mean, about obeying and disobeying, they wouldn't know. They knew the difference between good and evil. What that phrase is, that's what they call a merism. It's just like heavens and earth. It refers to two extremes, and it includes everything in between. The knowledge of good and evil is discernment, the ability to make fine distinctions, between gradations of things that are better or worse, or a little bit better, or parts of things that are good and parts of things that are bad. The kind of distinctions that an adult mind can make and a child's mind can't about good and evil. So all that to point out that when God created the Garden of Eden, He created a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was God's intention, I believe, right from the start, to open our eyes to truth. And then as you go through Scripture, you just see it over and over and over. In Genesis 21, when Sarah sent Hagar and her son packing, they gave some food, and Abraham gave them some food and water, but they ran out very quickly as they got into the desert, and then they were going to die, and Hagar couldn't stand to watch her baby die, so she left the baby and went a little ways away. And then it says God opened her eyes. Genesis 21:19. God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled a skin of water and gave the boy a drink. I mean, the well was there. She just didn't see it. And He enabled her to see it. He made her aware of it. I don't know how. I don't know how He brought it to her attention. Maybe some animal made a splash, or, you know, I don't know what. Maybe He just caused her to trip and fall into it or something. I don't know. Whatever. He drew her attention to this thing. And the point of that is significant. It's there, but it does her no good because she can't be aware of it without God causing her to be able to perceive that it's there. That's very similar to Isaac's near-death experience in the following chapter, in Genesis 22. Abraham is about to sacrifice his son Isaac on an altar, and at the last moment, God intervenes, and it says, "Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." And at that moment, verse 13, Abraham lifted his eyes, and there in a thicket, he saw a ram caught by its horns, and he went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. He didn't notice the ram before. Evidently, the ram was there. He just didn't become aware of it until God opened his eyes to see it. Maybe God had the ram suddenly rustle and make a bunch of noise, or maybe God just caused Abraham to turn a certain way and catch a glimpse out of his peripheral vision. I don't know. But God made him aware of something that he wasn't aware of otherwise. And what we can see from that is just because some wonderful thing exists and is available and is close by doesn't guarantee that we're going to be able to know about it. We're only able to perceive when God enables us to perceive. And the same is true for spiritual realities, even more so. Because spiritually, sinful mind, man is born blind. And only God can open his eyes. In 2 Kings 6, the servant's eyes were opened so that he could see the spiritual army that surrounded them. Remember? In Numbers 22, Balaam's eyes were opened so he could see the thing that his donkey could see all along, the angel standing in his way. And in Numbers 24:3, in his role as a prophet, he's referred to as the one whose eyes see clearly, who hears the words of God, and who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate, and whose eyes are opened. What a great definition for a prophet. We want to be aware of spiritual realities, but to do so, we need God to open our eyes. All of us have had experience of looking at God's Word and knowing that there's wonderful truth there, just not being able to get it. You know what I'm talking about? You're studying a passage and you're thinking, I know I'm missing something. I'm just not seeing the wonders that I know must be there. We can identify with the psalmist in Psalm 119:18 who says, "Open my eyes that I may see the wonderful things in your law." It's a divine action. It's a sovereign work of God that just enlightens you. Although, that's not to say that it doesn't have human element to it as well. There is human effort that's required. In the very same Psalm, Psalm 119, verse 148, he says, the same guy says, "My eyes stay open through the watches of the night that I may meditate on your promises." I mean, he worked hard at it. He studied. He's up all night reading it. And that effort, combined with this prayer in verse 18, opened my eyes to the wonders of it. What an amazing answer to that prayer came with Psalm 119. I guess God opened his eyes to the wonders of his word, didn't he? So with all that background, we can really appreciate the amazement of the people when they get the promise in Isaiah 35 of the Messiah. You may want to turn there, Isaiah 35, which is just such an incredible hope that the people based their lives on. Let's start right in verse 1 there. Isaiah 35, 1, "The desert and the parched land will be glad." This is talking about when the Messiah comes. "The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. It will burst into bloom and it will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. And they will see the glory of Yahweh, the splendor of our God. And then will the eyes of the blind be open and the ears of the deaf unstopped. And then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue shall shout for joy." At the end of the age, the Messiah is going to come, and someday the giver of life and the giver of light will enable everyone to eat from both the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Both our eyes will be opened, and the blind will see, and those who cannot speak will be able to speak, and those who cannot hear will hear. That's the great promise of the Messiah. Isaiah 29, 18, we see it again. "In that day the deaf will hear the words of the scroll, and out of gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind will see." Isaiah 42, 5, this is what God, Yahweh, says. "He who created the heavens and who stretched them out, who gives breath to its people and life to those who walk in it, I, Yahweh, have called you in righteousness. I will make you a light for the Gentiles to open eyes that are blind." And then Jesus comes onto the scene. And even with all the miracles of the past, all the miracles of Moses and the Exodus, all the miracles of Elijah and Elisha and all the rest, no blind person's ever been healed all the way through the Old Testament. Everyone who's blind just stays blind. But then Jesus explodes onto the scene, and everywhere he goes, opens the eyes of the blind and does all kinds of miracles, but no miracle more than opening the eyes of the blind and giving people sight, proving that he's the one who was to come and open people's eyes spiritually. In his first sermon in Nazareth, he started out by reading this passage from Isaiah about the Messiah. Luke 4:18. "The Spirit of the Lord," he's reading here from Isaiah, "the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim recovery of sight for the blind." Then he rolled up the scroll and set it down and gave it to the attendant. After his resurrection in Luke 24, he appeared to the apostles, and it says, and then in Luke 24:45, "Then he opened their minds so that they could understand the scriptures." He's the one that gives sight to the physically blind, and that shows he's the one that gives sight to the spiritually blind. Not only does Christ come in and give sight to the blind, but he also takes away sight from the unfaithful. And I'm going to have to skip over some of this stuff. I'm getting behind here. But if you want to read in Matthew 13 sometime, read about the fact that Christ judged the people who rejected him by taking away their ability to perceive truth. That's why he spoke in parables, so that they would not be able to see. See, when people allow their, and he says there, it's because their hearts are calloused. When you allow your heart to become callous, you lose. There comes a time when the lights go off. Just as Romans 1:21, "Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, and so their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened." They wouldn't give glory to God, and so God shut off their sight. John 9:39, after Jesus healed the man born blind, Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." And some Pharisees who were with him heard him say that and said, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." Just real quick, turn to Matthew 6. There's a kind of an interesting passage there that's kind of hard to understand at first, but really important here. One of the things our culture just cannot seem to understand is the fact that spiritual perception is not neutral. There's no such thing as objectivity in perception. Listen to Matthew 6:22. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Then if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? The eye is the lamp of the body. The point of that is your eye is your organ of perception. What enters your heart comes through your spiritual senses. If your eyes are good, that is, if you have discernment, your whole body will be full of light. Your heart will be full of truth. It'll be guided by truth. But if your eyes are bad, that is, if you lack discernment, if you have poor discrimination, if you can't see clearly spiritually, your whole body will be full of darkness. You're just going to be in the dark spiritually. And then this statement, if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? If that which enters your heart is not truth, you're in deep trouble. Think of how dark it is for the person whose eyes transform light into darkness. I mean, if you're just blind, you can use your other senses at least to figure out reality. But if you're sighted and your eyes transform rays of light into something that they're not, you're just always going to be hopelessly misled. That's why he says, how great is that darkness? It's worse than being blind. In order to know the truth, you have to have the kind of eyes that will accept the truth. That's the point of this. If your eyes reject the truth, then you're really hopeless. How great is the darkness that would be in you? The people were unable to hear Jesus because they were unwilling to accept what he was saying. And as a result, they became unable to understand. In John 8:43, why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. They're unable to hear because of what they wanted and what they didn't want. You see, in order to be able to perceive the truth, you have to have a bias toward the good, like we studied in the class on discernment. You remember that? You have to have a bias towards the good so that you'll accept it. Everyone has a bias, and it's either towards good or towards evil. And if you have a bias toward error, then you won't be able to accept the good. That's why Jesus went on in John 8 to say, yet because of the truth, because I tell you the truth, not in spite of the fact that I tell you the truth, because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe me? He who belongs to God hears what God says, and the reason you do not hear is because you do not belong to God. It's pretty clear. They loved error, so they couldn't understand the truth. You know, our society, they just think it's such a goal to become unbiased. News reporters pride themselves more than anything on being objective and unbiased, and they think that's the key to accuracy, but they're wrong. Because a judgment about whether something is good or bad is part of the truth. And to portray something that's good as anything other than good is misinformation. So, the more you allow your heart to become hard, the more you lose your ability to perceive, until finally it's gone altogether. Ephesians 4:17, I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. See, the ignorance is due to the hardening of their heart. They harden their hearts, no longer able to perceive, they become ignorant. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. I think the implication of all this is God creates all people with some ability to perceive, some limited ability to perceive, and based on how they respond to that, he either takes away that ability to perceive or opens their eyes further. Because even unbelievers are said to have had perception removed from them. There are varying degrees of spiritual enlightenment. There is some sense in which every single moment of understanding a truth could be described as enlightenment from God, a sovereign act of God. But there's a special sense in which a person's eyes are open, of course, at conversion. That's the greatest moment of enlightenment, when a person becomes a Christian. That's why Hebrews 6:4 and Hebrews 10:32, the moment of conversion is actually referred to as the day that you were enlightened. The moment when you were enlightened. Same thing in Acts 16:14 and 2 Corinthians 4:6. Your eyes are opened for the first time in that sense. And then you enter the process of just having your eyes opened wider and wider. And that's the progress of sanctification. Ephesians 1:18, that's why he prayed that the eyes of the people's hearts would be enlightened in order that they'd be able to know God more. Well, we better get back to our story here. Verse 30, back in Matthew 9. Says, Jesus warned them sternly. See that nobody knows about this. Now that's fascinating. Especially the language that Matthew uses here, because the word sternly is very strong. Jesus gets emotional. It's an emotional term. It's used of a roar or to storm with anger or to snort. It's used even of the snorting of a horse. Jesus became emotional. He says, do not tell anybody about this. Now, what is Jesus saying here? What does he want? Are we to take this literally, that Jesus literally does not want any person to find out that these guys are healed? What are they supposed to do? Go around and pretend they're blind? I mean, just walk around bumping into buildings and stuff like they're still blind? Obviously, people are going to know they're no longer blind. I mean, people that know them, people that they're around. I don't think that's the issue. Jesus is saying, I don't want you going out and making this your task to proclaim this far and wide. I don't want you going and traveling and spreading the news about Jesus. That's really what he was saying. And we see that in verse 31, because they go ahead and do it. They went out and they spread the news about him all over that region. You know, honor, somebody said honor is like a shadow. It flees from those who pursue it, and it pursues those who flee from it. And that's the way it is with Jesus. The deeds of Jesus were so wonderful, they couldn't be kept secret. And it's kind of odd to see this kind of disobedience. Jesus tells them to do something and they don't. Because we're going through the Gospels, and every time Jesus speaks, things happen. I mean, the demons instantly obey, diseases flee, death releases its grip at Christ's command, even storms and wind and waves obey his word instantaneously and totally. But he gives one simple command to a human being, and he disobeys. You know, human beings are unique in that respect. We are unique in our ability to disobey our Creator. And that, you know, the inanimate creation can't do that. You know, you understand that, right? I mean, he has full, total control, direct control over everything in nature. There's not a renegade molecule anywhere in this universe who doesn't instantaneously do exactly what God commands every single time. In this world, only man disobeys God. And that's really a wonderful truth. You say, what's so wonderful about that? Because you realize what that means? That means that we are unique also in our capacity. We are the only ones who have the capacity to willfully obey God. Right? Love is meaningful only when the person has the freedom to not love and chooses to love. And we're the only ones that have the ability to do that. We're the only ones that can decide to obey God, and that gives meaning to it. Well, Jesus has healed the woman who was bleeding now, and then she had that whole conversation. Then he traveled to Jairus' house, and he dismissed the first crowd, and then he goes in and he dismisses all the mourners, and then he raises the girl from the dead and has that whole thing. And now he's traveling back to his house, and once again is interrupted by the blind men, and they cry out and follow him into his house, and he has the interaction with them and ends up healing them. Now look at verse 32. While they're going out, someone else comes. Another person. This time it's a demon-possessed person who could not talk. He was mute. Again, constant pressure, relentless. Never end. Jesus' whole ministry was just this never-ending stream of tragic individuals around him all the time. Never a break. Verse 33, when the demon was driven out, the man who had been mute spoke. Just like, I mean, he's getting to the point now where he doesn't even tell you about the miracle. The miracle's already over. The demon's driven out now and he's gone. And now the guy's talking. In verse 32, the guy was demon-possessed. This particular miracle doesn't get a lot of attention. You don't hear much about it. You never hear anybody talk about it. It's recorded only here, only in one gospel. And even Matthew only gives it a half a verse. Six Greek words. Yet it was no less spectacular than all the other miracles. And we see that from the response here. It says the crowd was astonished. They're amazed. And they say, nothing like this has ever been seen. Once again, Jesus effortlessly overcomes a demon and throws him out and then heals the man. And he does so in such a dramatic fashion that it just blows the people away. So don't be fooled by the brevity of the account. They had not ever seen anything like this. The rabbis taught, nothing happened. Jesus opened his mouth, demons fled, storms obeyed, nature itself snapped to attention, the dead were raised, sins were forgiven, and the kingdom of God was established. And so they say, nothing like this has ever been seen. And if you think about it, that's really an astonishing statement for Jews to make. A people whose history books are crowded with miracles from the very first day of their existence, and who took great pride in all of that, for them to say nothing like this has ever been seen in the history of Israel is an amazing statement. Their whole history was amazing miracles, but Jesus' miracles eclipsed all of the ones in the Old Testament. So these people, at this point, they're beyond just curious amusement. They are singling Jesus out here as unique, which is exactly the kind of things that put the Pharisees into a panic. And so they react in verse 34. And the Pharisees said, when they heard that, it says, it is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons. And there they are, back to that accusation. They saw all that Jesus did and they concluded that he was satanic. That's just incredible. You know, they have condemned him just in this one chapter. They've condemned him now three times. And if you really wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt and you really use your imagination, you might be able to think of some possible good motives for some of the other ones. In verse 3, Jesus claimed to be able to forgive sin. And, you know, if he's not God, then they're correct in saying that that's actually blasphemy because only God can forgive sins. And maybe they didn't realize he was God. He's conversing with tax collectors and sinners in verse 11, and they condemned him for that. And, you know, if they're thinking, well, he's doing that because he's attracted to that lifestyle, well, then they would be correct that would be a wrong thing. In verse 14, they condemned him for fasting. And, you know, maybe we can give him the benefit of the doubt there. Maybe they're thinking, well, he just doesn't have the self-discipline. That's why he doesn't fast. He just doesn't have command over his appetites. And so that could be a point of criticism. But when they say this, when they vomit out this accusation, they just show that their hearts, there is absolutely no good motive in their heart. They're just 100% wicked and vile and evil. Their hearts are as impure as they can be. They see the purest, most wonderful, pristine being in existence, and they conclude that he's satanic. Now, I've told you before that Jesus' miracles were not random, that they had a purpose. Primarily, number one, to validate his claims, number two, to show his power, and number three, to give previews of what the kingdom is going to be like. When Jesus is showing us what the kingdom is going to be like, he restores sight and speech. Now that's significant. Why do you suppose that is? For that matter, why do you suppose it is that God gave us sight and speech to begin with? Let's think this through. These miracles remind us that those abilities, those physical abilities, were given by God for some purpose. And they were given by God in the first place for a purpose, and they're going to be restored in the kingdom to come for some purpose. There's got to be a reason, a good reason. God could have never given us those things. You know, he could have just created us all blind and all mute, and none of us would have ever known the difference. If nobody was sighted, there's no such thing. There'd be no such thing as sight or speaking, and nobody would know any difference. But God gave us faculties of both perception and communication. impression and expression. And we're stewards of our abilities to speak and to perceive. We're not just given those abilities just to spice up our lives a little bit. There's a reason. Remember when we were studying gifts and I said, if you got a job and you went into your new office and there's your nice big desk and it's all clean and clear except right in the center of your desk sits some tool, the first thing you do is go to your boss and say, what am I supposed to use this for, right? Well, that should be exactly our response when we look and see the way that God has equipped us. The biggest question in our minds is, if God gave us eyes and mouths, why did he do that? Why did he give us the ability to communicate and to perceive? You've been given the ability to read or to hear and to understand ideas. Why? God has maybe made you with the ability to communicate well, or what are you supposed to use those tools for? Everything you have, your emotions, your senses, your abilities. Maybe you have the ability to fix things, or maybe you could have a great eye for art or beauty, or maybe you have the ability to cook or whatever it is. All of those things, conglomerated, packaged them all together in just the right proportions in a package called you. And he did that for some reason. It's not just a fluke. And the only meaning to life is to discover that reason and to fulfill it. God gave us perception because he wanted us to perceive, to be good stewards of that ability. Let me ask you this. Is there any good reason why God shouldn't take your sight away tomorrow? I mean, other than his mercy, just his mercy. Is there any reason why he shouldn't take away your ability to speak? Any reason for his kingdom at all? Now, I'm not suggesting that he will do that. But I'm just asking, is there any reason why he shouldn't? And I'm not saying this to try and generate any guilt. That would be to miss the point. The idea is not that I'm trying to point out, oh, you're probably failing to do what you're supposed to be doing. What I'm trying to do is arouse in you a sense of encouragement and mission in your heart, when you realize that you've been given tools, very important, powerful tools. That's not a source of guilt, it's a source of encouragement. I mean, that's what gives meaning to life. That's the whole reason why we exist. The fact that you have those tools means, number one, you've been placed here at this place, at this time, for some important task. And number two, you are obviously equipped by God to do whatever the task is. Think of the energy that our society, our culture, devotes to sight and sound. I mean, everything revolves around those two things. We don't have to discipline ourselves to perceive. In some sense, it's automatic. I mean, the whole time you're awake, and to some degree, the time you're sleeping as well, your mind is going. And you can't stop the perception. I mean, if you put on a blindfold, suddenly all your other senses take over perceiving the world and become that much more acute. We automatically perceive things, but that ability to perceive, and especially the ability to perceive spiritually, can be squandered or misused. Your eyes can be bad, according to Matthew 6. And it's so crucial that we don't let them become bad. It's a striking contrast. But in the same passage, do you notice these men are given their sight, the blind men are given their sight, and the mute are given the ability to speak, and at the very same moment, the Pharisees show themselves absolutely unable to perceive truth, unwilling to perceive truth, and use their mouths to call Jesus satanic. Our ability to perceive and understand and to think and to have abstract, complex thoughts and then to communicate those to God and to each other, all of those things are gifts from God that he expects us to use. That's what sets us apart from the animals. That's what makes us unique. That's a part of what it means to be in God's image. In our study of Genesis, we found that the ability to speak is a tremendously important part of personhood. That's what it means to be a person. Communication is the basis for personal relationships. That's what we're designed for. Perception and speech are the faculties of relationship. And they enable us to commune with God and with one another. Which is really appropriate that we should get to this passage on this particular Sunday when we celebrate communion, the Lord's table, fellowship with the Lord. And then we're going to, in a few moments, have our fellowship meal and have time of fellowship with one another and communion with one another. This is a great principle to keep in mind, that our ability to hear and to listen and to understand and then to speak, to interact, is a very high and holy tool placed in your hands by God. We have the choice to be like these Pharisees and to squander these gifts and ultimately lose them. Or we can show gratitude for them by developing them, using them for His glory, and living in hope of the day when they'll be fully restored.